Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up today, an Australian aid worker is being questioned in Libya. Reports are surfacing that Japan will suspend whaling. In Papua New Guinea, election ballot boxes were destroyed in Jawaka province. We have this and more on this edition of the program. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Australia's Foreign Minister Bob Carr has confirmed that an Australian aid worker is being refused permission to leave Libya. Libyan authorities have been questioning the woman, Alexandra Bean, over a murky legal case. Miss Bean's brother says he wants the Australian authorities to do more to secure her freedom. Barbara Miller speaks to Australia's Foreign Minister Bob Carr.
I understand that Alexandra Bean was detained at Tripoli Airport. Briefly, by Libyan police. I understand that it's about an investigation they've got going into a senior Libyan official. She wasn't arrested, and I'm told she's not the subject of the police investigation, but it would seem they want a witness statement. She's now been released, but she's unable to leave the country.
Is it your understanding that that investigation relates to allegations that a senior health official may have sexually assaulted Ms. Bean?
I understand that the subject of the police investigation is in fact a senior Libyan official, but I don't think it's appropriate that I talk about what the subject of the investigation is. Our consul, speaking to her from Cairo, has assured her that he is ready to assist in liaising with Libyan authorities, and he is in fact doing that.
Now, Ms. Bean's brother has been speaking to the ABC. He says he feels Australian authorities are not doing enough, that the consul in Cairo has been aware of the situation for a couple of days, and that a lawyer or some representative should be sent there to help her. What do you say to that?
Well, it's a classic problem with consular cases. Australia does not provide its nationals overseas in trouble with foreign jurisdictions with legal assistance.
But you've just said that she's not in trouble as far as you know. There's no question or no suggestion that she's in trouble.
I think you're splitting words. You've just asked me why we haven't sent a lawyer in, and I'm saying that it's not our practice to send lawyers in to Australians who might have some argument or might be in some trouble with a foreign jurisdiction. We don't fight cases for Australians in the courts.
You're saying that they simply want to question her as a witness. That's not an argument, is it?
Well, again, I think you're splitting hairs here, and I don't think that coming down on one definition or the other really helps us with the point. An Australian has been detained, an Australian has been prevented from leaving Libya. We're offering that Australian every consular assistance, as we do in all similar cases.
But the bottom line is she has to cooperate with Libyan authorities for as long as they wish to hold her there.
Well, I'm afraid that when you're in a different country, it is the laws of that country, not the laws of Australia, which apply. Nonetheless, we will provide in this case, as we do in all comparable cases, consular assistance. But Australian laws cannot be applied, and the Australian government doesn't provide lawyers for its nationals who have an argument with a foreign jurisdiction.
That was Australian Foreign Minister Bob Carr speaking to Barbara Miller. A report in one of Japan's leading newspapers says the country's fishery agency is considering to suspend or cancel this year's whaling hunt in the Antarctic. The move comes after years of bitter confrontations between the ships of Japan's whaling fleet and those in the anti-whaling activist group Sea Shepherd. Eleanor Hall asks ABC Radio's North Asia correspondent Mark Woolsey, how credible is this report?
The report is in the Asahi newspaper, and that's one of the more respected papers here. And it says the Japanese Fisheries Agency is considering suspending this year's whaling hunt in the Southern Ocean, and the reason is the fleet's aging factory ship. The 8,000-ton Nishin Maru has been involved in Japan's so-called scientific whaling program since it began 25 years ago. So it's the biggest ship in the fleet. The workers on the Nishin Maru, they're involved in taking the whales apart, removing the bits and pieces needed in this so-called scientific research. Now, we've spoken to Japan's fisheries agency this morning. They've refused to confirm this newspaper report, but the agency does admit it wants to refurbish and repair the factory ship. They actually have a meeting on Friday to discuss this. And once the plan is accepted, apparently, they will talk to a shipbuilding company about repairs. Repairs that will take several months, meaning that will put this year's hunt in the Antarctic in grave doubt.
So is the repair of the ship likely to be the key reason for delaying the whale hunt, or could this be a way for Japan to end its whaling without losing face?
It's no secret that the Nisshin Maru does need repairs. It's been involved, as I say, for a quarter of a century in Japan's whaling program, 25 straight years of so-called scientific whaling. But I think there's an overall cost factor at play here, Eleanor. This is a country facing an earthquake and tsunami repair bill of hundreds of billions of dollars. Then there's the clean-up and compensation bill from the Fukushima nuclear disaster. That's hundreds of billions more. And Japan has, we all know, the greatest public debt in the industrialised world, so there's not a lot of cash to splash about. And while this whaling program is supposed to be for science and research, the Fisheries Agency is allowed to sell the meat. But as I say, very few Japanese actually eat it. There are stockpiles of whale meat sitting in freezers around the country. I think only 5% of Japanese actually eat it regularly, and at last count, there were 6,000 tonnes of this whale meat in freezers around Japan. So this is a program that's not making any money. It relies for its very survival on government subsidies. And the mood here is that the money should be going on the people who need it, people in the tsunami and nuclear zones, not on programs Japan doesn't need.
So if there are cost issues for suspending or cancelling the whaling program, how will it be received by those who supported whaling in the past?
Well, I don't think it'll be received very well because they can argue that it's not a lot of money in the greater scheme of things. And it's true, there will be a backlash from more nationalistic elements as well as right-wing opposition politicians. They will argue that this is a capitulation to the eco-terrorists at Sea Shepherd, a capitulation to those in the West who want to push Japan around. So expect a vociferous reaction from the opposition Liberal Democratic Party, which, for 50 years when they were in government, they were ardent supporters of whaling and whaling communities all around Japan. In fact, a pro-whaling faction of the Liberal Democratic Party held a meeting yesterday, we've just learned, and it warned that a suspension, even if it's a suspension for 1 year, well, that would hurt Japan's international image. And I think by that they mean Japan's image as a nation that doesn't want to be pushed around.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio. Police in Papua New Guinea have launched an investigation into an armed attack in Jawaka province, where around 100,000 votes from the recent general election were burnt. Around two dozen men, some carrying high-powered rifles, overpowered security staff who were guarding the counted votes. Michael Pa, the general manager of Asla Security, which was responsible for guarding the ballot boxes in the province, describes to our own John McIntyre what happened.
It was a brazen and coordinated attack that led to an estimated 100,000 counted votes being burned in Papua New Guinea's Jawaka province.
Three unmarked vehicles drove into the yard and then they held up the security guards with high-powered guns.
Michael Parr is the general secretary of Asila Security, whose security staff were in charge of guarding the counted votes. He says around 15 to 20 men overpowered the five unarmed guards on duty and proceeded to burn down the room that stored the votes.
They came across to the security guards, five in total, and then they held them up and then told them to lie on the ground face down, and then some watched over them with guns, and then the rest of these men who came in the three vehicles went across to where the containers which kept the ballot boxes, and then they pour kerosene in and then benzene in and then bend all the contents in there, the ballot boxes and the cables.
The Jawaka seat is one of 80 that is being contested. Almost two-thirds of the seats in Parliament have now been challenged. Dr. Joseph Ketton is a visiting fellow at the Institute of Papua New Guinea Studies and was part of the domestic observer mission for the elections. He was on the ground in Jawaka province as the vote went ahead and saw many discrepancies in the poll and counting during the elections held during June and July.
The election was generally in a peaceful and orderly manner, but the poll was neither free nor fair. There was a lot of intimidation. There was a lot of collective, coerced voting. The secret ballot principle was compromised. This, in turn, disenfranchised a lot of women. There was a lot of underage voting. The common roll was discarded about 10-20 minutes into the polling.
It's discrepancies like these that have led so many of the election results to be challenged, though most challenges are, of course, using more conventional methods than sending armed men to set fire to ballot boxes. Police are now investigating the arson in Javaka, but no matter the outcome of the investigation, it's fair to say that the arson has already served its purpose. The burned votes mean that no one will actually know who legitimately won the Javaka seat.
No, the process has been compromised now. There will not be a case to go to the courts now, because the ballot papers are no longer there. Don't think this matter will go through the courts now. The petition process is usually free and fair in this country. But there are so many cases that it will clog up the system, and it will take the next 3, 4, 5 years to go through all of them.
Stephen Lawrence is the chairman of Transparency International in Papua New Guinea, a group that campaigns for greater accountability in government. He says it's not the first time that votes have been burned in Papua New Guinea following a general election.
Some years ago now, there was virtually a bomb went off in a police station in the Anger district, and that was to do with getting rid of ballot papers that people didn't want to have counted. These things do take place when there's a lot of competition and a lot of high, you know, heavy feelings around election results.
But despite the many criticisms of the electoral process, Stephen Lawrence says that Papua New Guinea should be proud of carrying out elections that were, for the most part, free and fair.
It does need to be remembered that these are very difficult things to conduct in a country the nature of Papua New Guinea. The logistics, the social challenges, the geographic challenges, so many things make it quite difficult. And overall, we should be quite proud of what has been achieved and simply continue to look for ways to make things better.
The president of Nauru has told the United Nations General Assembly the organization is awash in unfulfilled promises. Sarpento Dabiwado says the failure of multilateral institutions could not be more evident than in the ongoing climate change negotiations. A report on climate change says that more than 100 million people will die by 2030 if the world fails to tackle global warming. More than 90% of those deaths will occur in developing nations and are a direct result of human economic impacts. The report was commissioned by a partnership of 20 developing countries currently threatened by rapid climate change. We have this story from Geraldine Coutts.
Arctic sea ice dropped to its lowest extent in recorded history, shattering the previous record by a jaw-dropping 18%. Some scientists are now predicting that the Arctic Ocean could be ice-free during summer in as little as 5 years. The ice melt is already wreaking significant havoc on weather patterns around the globe and has probably contributed to the historic heat waves that struck many places this year. Just last week, a new study found that half of all coral reefs could be lost with a temperature rise above 1.2 degrees Celsius. The scientists further concluded that, and I quote, "There is little doubt coral reefs will no longer be prominent within coastal ecosystems if global average temperatures exceed 2 degrees Celsius," unquote.
That was Nauru's president, Sprint Davido, in his speech to the United Nations General Assembly. Now, a new report on climate change says more than 100 million people will die by 2030 if the world fails to tackle climate change. More than 90% of those deaths will occur in developing countries and are a direct result of human and economic impacts. The report was commissioned by a partnership of 20 developing countries currently threatened by rapid climate change.
Ross Mountain, who's the Director General of DARA, says the world's poorest nations are the most vulnerable. He joins us now online from New York. Ross Mountain, a very good afternoon to you. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Now, there's not a very pleasant prediction. How do you see this unfolding, your prediction, 100 million people dying by 2030?
Well, first of all, let me say that having just heard the president of Nauru, I think it's very timely what he said. It's a very timely warning, and what we need is more action. This 100 million people breaks down into 5 to 6 million a year now, rising to 6 in 2030. What we have been able to do with this report is to unmask the fiction that addressing climate change now is an economic luxury. We are pointing out that in fact the loss globally from the damage that is done by climate change already is approximately 2% of world GNP, where it would take maybe 0.5% to deal with it. This is extremely relevant, if I may say so, for the Pacific Island countries, for the small island developing states. We estimate for the SIDS that while we talk in global terms of sort of going to 2030 to 3% of GNP, for the SIDS we see it moving from sort of 2% now, maybe 3% now indeed, with the impact of the carbon economy, to something like 6% of GNP in 2030. And the SIDS, of course, have their own set of problems with coral, with fisheries, with energy. So it's the whole issue of ocean acidification and so on. So I can but applaud the comments made by the president of Nauru.
Now, more than 90% of the deaths will occur in developing countries. We still are having the debate by some as to whether climate change is man-made or what the issue is, or even if it does exist in addition to it being just a natural trend which will correct itself somewhere along the line. There's also the debate over carbon emissions and taxes and those that are absolutely fighting against it. If your predictions are true, what is going to galvanise any of the governments into action?
Well, one would hope that the logic of the economics, if not the moral attraction, hopefully, of the figures that you're citing, will get governments going. We approach this from a human dimension, and we have put together looked at 34 indicators for the climate economy and climate change to come up with our figures. And we are now showing, as I mentioned, that economically it makes for political leaders today not dealing with carbon, with climate change and the carbon economy means they're wasting money. It would be better for them to spend money on it now because it will be cheaper in the very near term. The Climate Vulnerable Forum, who you mentioned is sponsoring this forum, has 3 Pacific members, Vanuatu, Tuvalu, and Kiribati, who have played a prominent role in this whole exercise, by the way.
Now, have we gone beyond the point? Is it at the point of no return? Because even in your report, you're saying climate scientists have warned that the chance of limiting the rise to below 2 degrees is getting smaller as global greenhouse gas emissions rise due to burning fossil fuels. Have we gone beyond that point of no return?
Not quite yet, but if one spends a lot more time in these kind of sterile debates as whether or not climate change exists and can be modified by immediate action, adaptation, and mitigation, then we will go. The International Energy Agency has said we actually have less than 5 years to get the structures in shape to keep us below the 2 degree issue. If we don't take urgent action, then we will indeed. And at the moment, we're on track for going up well beyond the 2 degrees to 4 and even above that. By the way, notwithstanding the debate that is still raging, and unfortunately there are far too many people who still do not seem to understand the logic of the scientific evidence. Something like 93% of the scientists in this business who deal with climate are the same proportion as who believe that HIV causes AIDS actually are very clear on this subject. So there is quite a lot of obfuscation, to put not to put too fine a word on it, in the way that debate is carried on.
Governments and businesses are arguing that in these fiscally constraining times that they can't afford to put any more money into carbon emissions, carbon and taxes, because it's going to cost them too much, to and the sustainability side of it, although they're doing as much as they can in the Pacific. Victorian government, for instance, has the rebate on solar has gone from 25 cents to down to 8 cents, the return to people who use it. So what's it going to take to convince governments that they're just not getting the message?
I think we're looking at a change in the economic model in terms of understanding that new technology can create new jobs, clean energy, which will save lives and save money. It does indeed require some upfront investment, but the realization of the benefits of that are now fairly manifest if people do collaborate together.
And finally, for centuries, rare and exotic animals have been hunted for use in Chinese traditional medicine. One of the most threatened animals is the tiger, and has been hunted close to extinction. This is partially due to the risk the animal poses to humans, but also because its penis is highly valued at treating erectile dysfunction in men. Liam Cochrane speaks to Dr. Kenneta Hong, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Hong Kong Baptist University.
I don't think it's as popular as it used to be. I think people are becoming more conscious of the environment. But I think if you go for the wild gaming and poaching, it's really the game for the rich and famous, as it is in, you know, everywhere else. For the average people, I don't think this is what they use. So I don't think it's as popular these days.
So why do you think that that Western drugs, such as Viagra, might be a plausible alternative?
You know, for Western medicine, it's very much marketed as something that's efficient, that's science, that's proven results. And if you're looking for a male with a condition, this is Western medicine is the right way to go. So I think it would be very well accepted.
But if it is mostly popular amongst the rich and famous, as you say, would they be a particularly hard sector of Chinese society to try and convince to change their old ways?
It would take some convincing. There are, you know, ways they are used to, but it can be changed. I mean, if you look at the birth rate in China, if you look at a younger generation, a lot of them are looking for fewer children. So I think it can be changed. It would take some take a little while to do that.
Mm. Well, tell us about the health system that underpins this. The traditional Chinese system operates alongside Western style medicine. I mean, what role? How could doctors perhaps promote Viagra as a better alternative for male impotence?
For the doctors in China, they often use both the Chinese traditional medicine and the Western medicine interchangeably or even together. Now, going back to what I say about Western medicine, people think it's efficient, there's science, there's proven results, and, you know, if you have a condition, you want results. So that would work very well for that aspect. But at the same time, Western drugs are often thought of as having potential side effects. It might be too strong, too targeted, and you want more of a balance for your health, for your body. And this is where Chinese medicine comes in. So very often you go to a hospital, you get both the traditional practitioner and the Western doctor, so to speak, working together on the patient. So I think there's a very effective way to push Western medicine like Viagra, but at the same time, potentially use Chinese approaches to help regulate some of the side effects that people are concerned with.
And what about costs? At these days, because of the rarity of tiger parts and rhino horns and these kinds of things, it's incredibly expensive. Could the cost be a selling point?
Would the cost be a selling point?
Yes, for Viagra and for Western-style medicines.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I think for tiger penis and things like that, it's for the average people, it's really a myth more than, you know, what people actually take these days.
Well, let me ask you about that. What kind of is there any scientific research that proves that tiger penis or rhino horn actually works?
Well, I am not aware of the research. I don't think you can do that kind of research anymore.
It's probably quite illegal to try, isn't it?
Absolutely. People don't do that kind of research, but it's more a myth, I would say. People have been saying that. Some people said that it works, but I don't think there are proven results as such.
And with that, we've come to the end of another edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, our email address is very simple, focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. You can also listen to this program again by going to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. You'll also find information at our website for the show, where you can subscribe to it in iTunes. So on behalf of everyone that put the program together, I'm Keith Parent wishing you well. We'll see you in 7 days' time. Bye-bye, everyone.